Anyhow, we are past 7:30 at this point, so I think we should go ahead and get started. Welcome all. Welcome to any guests that are with us tonight. As always, we welcome guests at the Ottawa Peace User Group meetings. You don't have to be a member, but as I always say, if everybody joined as a guest, we wouldn't last very long. So if you find it of particular use to be a member, the content that you're getting out of us is worth $20 or more, please consider joining our group. And I pasted into the chat the link where you can actually go to sign up for the group, or you can find it off our homepage on the menu bar across the top, join or renew. So we have a number of items queued up. We should have a little bit of time, I think, by the end of the meeting to pick up any of the things that people want that didn't make it into the deck. So you can either put it into the chat or you can wait and we will open up the microphones afterwards. Right now I'm going to mute all, and everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or question, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And with that, I will toss it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away. And Alan, you're muted. Looking around for the controls. Let me ask you to unmute.
It's because it just popped up, this meeting is being recorded, and then covered up my control.
Oh.
Okay, sorry about that. All right, so we're going to start off tonight with a couple of follow-up items from, I think both were last week. And certainly the first one, there was some discussion about Kaspersky antivirus. And this all came about because we were talking about updating Windows device drivers. And somehow we got onto antivirus and security suites. And there was this question posted in the chat window. Feel free to post questions in the chat window. We usually try to go back through the chat and cover everything, but we actually missed this one. And the question was, how do you rate Kaspersky, the antivirus product? So the question is, how do members rate Kaspersky? So I put the question in the members only forum, and a bunch of answers came in. So we're going to cover some of those tonight. I think we're going to cover all of them tonight. And we're going to start off, and Chris can probably talk to his own response.
Yeah, so there was some controversy right now about the fact that the U.S. is actually banning the sale in the U.S. of products from Kaspersky. Now, the ban isn't immediate for large organizations in particular, but it looks like it's going to eventually extend to all organizations. And the quote here out of the Global News article, there are concerns the firm is closely tied to Russia and poses a security risk. And there's not an awful lot of detail, as one would likely expect. There wouldn't be an awful lot of detail about what sort of security risk there is. But I think the overall concern is that Russia could either embed things into products that are sold around the world that might be spyware or who knows what. So one of the things to think about is that if you're really concerned about how effective Kaspersky is, note that it is one of the main antivirus products out there. So, you know, this spring, AV Tests, which tests antivirus products on an ongoing basis, they did rate it as a top product. Now, there are about 10 products that are rated as top product. But if you're concerned about it in terms of effectiveness, then I don't think you have to really worry about it on that grounds. Next. So when it comes to things being rated as top tier, or whether they're, you know, 9 out of 10 or 9.5 out of 10 or whatever, I don't really worry an awful lot about placement of rating scales. What is the leading product this month might be not the leading product next month. And things like that. But there are a lot of products that are rated as top-tier products, and by a lot of different websites or whatever that actually rate these products. One of the key things, takeaways, I think, is that really in my Protecting Your PC presentation that I've given a couple of times for the Ottawa PC User Group, and I've given about 90 times at the Ottawa Public Library, I advocate just pick one of the main ones and stick with it and keep it up to date. And keeping it up to date is really the key thing. Getting those signature files, every day that come out, making sure that the product is protecting as well as it can. Now, there are a lot of the main top-tier AV products that are not free. You know, they are commercial offerings. There are some commercial offerings that have a free version as well, and usually the AV portion is exactly the same as the commercial product. Their commercial product might give you extras like parental controls or an enhanced firewall or who knows what. But the basic AV product is actually identical to the paid version. So there are free AV solutions, and there are some that are pure free, like Microsoft Defender, that is also considered a top-tier product. And that's what I advocate, is using Microsoft Defender. It's fairly lightweight. It updates easily as part of the Windows update process. And it is considered by many to be one of the top products out there. And I really think the last point is key. Don't jump from one product to another product just because, oh, this one happens to be rated higher. As I say, it might be different next month. And so chasing the latest winner is a mug's game. You're just going to waste your time, waste your money. And that's
okay,
it, I
guess. And that is some up-to-date news about Kaspersky. Came in a couple of days ago on one of the computer websites, and they've announced that they're actually shutting down their U.S. operations completely and laying off all their staff. So Kaspersky won't be available in the U.S., and I guess support is going to be somewhat more difficult in the future if you're using that product.
I'm presuming,
even
with that shutting down, though, I would presume that if you're using Kaspersky products, you'll still be able to get signature updates. There will be ways that you can get newer versions of the program, just not through their U.S. operations.
Yeah, I'm sure that's.
Yeah.
You may not be able to pay for them.
Say, if you're using Kaspersky, it's probably worth following up anyway.
Yeah.
If you've already paid for it, it's probably okay. But I think if you wanted to buy it in the U.S., you would be forbidden from sending any money to Kaspersky.
Yeah.
It may not be able to prevent that over the web.
Of course, we're in the USA. We're in Canada, so we can buy it from anywhere where it comes from. I've been using it for 12 years. And found it a superior product. Just the last iteration, they've put in some bloatware to do things that really I don't want it to do. It doesn't matter. It's not harmful, but occasionally the pop-up screen gets in the way and asking to clean something up. But it's not mandatory. If it comes across a bug in your system or a website you're trying to hook onto, it'll definitely tell you don't go there. That's for sure, and it seems to be very accurate in ferreting these things out. So apart from that, I found it just a good product.
So we did get some other opinions that did come in. So, Alan, are you frozen, Alan? Alan appears to be frozen.
Okay, thanks, Rick. So other member opinions. This is my end.
Alan, if you can hear me, you're breaking up and so forth. Oh, Alan's gone. I guess he'll be coming back. I'll give him a minute. Otherwise, I can share the deck from my computer. But we did get some comments come in from, there Alan's back. Let me, there he goes. Okay.
Okay, I think we're back in business, right?
Yep.
Okay, sorry about that. My internet must have just dropped out. So I told Stuart that by posting this, he's going to have the both the Russians and the Chinese after him, but they'll probably never track him down in Shawinigan, so he'll be okay. Anyway, I think that was a little tongue-in-cheek, Stuart, as usual. Elizabeth said that she bought Kaspersky a number of years ago, and she bought a three-year membership deal. But after the first year, they asked her to renew her annual membership, and she kept telling them that she had a three-year membership. But they kept on asking for more money, so at the end of the third year, she dropped it. But she said, if they can't get small things like that right, how can they get the big stuff right? And she says, well, maybe there's an admin branch and a developer branch, and maybe they are different, but she wasn't convinced. Somebody else said they've been using Kaspersky for more than 10 years. They thought their protection was excellent. It was updated several times a day. It has more features, has a VPN included, a virtual private network. It has the capability for monitoring hard drive temperature, and it blocks ads. And it had good lab support. One of the things was, he says, itfactory.ca is a good source for Kaspersky software as a Canadian website supplier, but he says many other Canadian suppliers have discontinued selling Kaspersky, so it may not be as readily available as you might think. Another member says they used it for a number of years and really liked it, but when this controversy about being Russian blew up, this member switched to Bitdefender, the paid version of Bitdefender, and has been happy with that as a substitute. And then Bob Walker notes that the controversy about the Russian government ties, possibly, and again the advice, general advice, to pick one product and stick with it. And he says it can be Microsoft Defender. It's built into Windows. It's free. It's readily available. Mostly people will purchase Gen Digital products. And that's a software company in the US and the Czech Republic. And they've bought up a whole bunch of cybersecurity software developers, including Norton, Avast, AVG, and Avira. And Bob lists some of the products: Norton Antivirus, Avast Premium, Avast Secure Browser, the AVG series, the suites, and then the same thing with Avira. And the other thing that they produce, everybody's probably heard of, CC Cleaner, and then Recuva, which is a software restoration program, and some other products. So there's a lot of other products out there if you don't want to stick with Kaspersky, and those are some of the offerings. Okay, next up we have a follow-up on the other item that we talked about last week, which was the Ticketmaster breach. And a member sent in his experience having received the email from Ticketmaster that his credit card was compromised. And he notes that he uses a credit card with a low spending limit, specifically to buy things online. And it was that card that was compromised. So he called the customer service number for his credit card and told them that he received this data breach notification from Ticketmaster. And they had a protocol in place. They canceled the old card. They're going to issue a new one, even though there are no suspicious charges on the card, and that basically is that bank's policy. And now, although you can't make purchases on that card, he can still get the refunds, that any refunds that might be due to that credit card number. So his recommendation is to notify your bank, your credit card provider, about the data breach, and then see what they have in terms of protocols. his bank gave him the number for the credit monitoring by TransUnion through Ticketmaster, but that was going to take a few weeks, and he's decided he's going to call them directly, TransUnion directly, and sign up and avoid any undue delay.
I think if you have been involved in the breach. Yeah, I think there's one takeaway from this that I would certainly look at is the fact that when he called the credit card company, they canceled his credit card immediately. And so I would not notify your credit card company if you're about to head out on a trip or you don't have another credit card. You may be, a week without that credit card. And so I'd be a little bit careful about calling your credit card company because, as you said, it was non-negotiable. But got canceled immediately.
Also, if you have any repeating transactions, repeating payments on your credit card, I know I have, and in that case, you don't want it to disappear during the time those payments are applied.
Yeah.
Natalie says some credit cards can be replaced, but you can use the old one until the new one is activated.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound like that was the case here.
Yeah, if you want to keep it active, don't notify your bank again. Okay, I haven't been following the chat, Chris, so I'm hoping we haven't missed anything.
Everything is good there. I think there was, just a comment on the from Joss going back to the Kaspersky one. If they shut down, they might have a harder time to get threat signatures originating in the U.S. Become less effective. That certainly sounds like it might be the case. And I would certainly be concerned if they're shutting down U.S. operations totally, whether, Kaspersky is going to disappear as a product even. Who knows? Joss, in terms of this one for the Ticketmaster, he says, the issue for the future is not ordering tickets using Ticketmasters, which is often the only method. And it's a lot of places. If you want to order tickets to something, Ticketmaster is the only game.
Okay.
And he also, just before we go on, he also asks, if you call yourself, do you get fees? I don't think you would ever get hit with a fee on that. I mean, I've called my credit card company on a couple of occasions and had suspicious charges or some reason where I thought it might be compromised or was contacted by the credit card company saying that my card had been used at a place where fraud had occurred and that they were canceling my card and would issue a new one. I was never charged fees on that.
Well, does he mean that or does he mean the credit tracking fee?
I don't know on that one. The TransUnion one is being paid for by Ticketmaster, but Equifax is, my understanding is it's not being covered by Ticketmaster, so you probably are going to be on the hook for anything you do through Equifax.
Okay, so moving along, we've got an item coming up that's got some computer jargon in it, and we had some comments from a member that sometimes the things we talk about, we go very quickly and we don't really explain some fairly basic things. So one of the things I noticed in this next presentation from Chris was that he's got a whole bunch of menu type items and maybe people don't know what the different icons mean. And here's a quick and dirty for the hamburger menu are these three lines. Clearly, it's supposed to be a little bit more basic than the hamburger on the left. It's just the top of a bun and the bottom of a bun and the meat patty in between. So that's called the hamburger menu. And Chris tells me that the three vertical dots is called a kebab menu. Now, I thought that the three horizontal dots was the kebab menu because to me, that looks like three meatballs on a stick, a skewer, like a kebab menu. But you notice that I've got my kebabs on the grill at 45 degrees, so it could actually be either. Anyway, Chris insists that the three vertical dots is the kebab menu, and the three horizontal dots is the meatball menu. So if we're talking about hamburgers and kebabs and meatballs, we're either hungry or we're talking about icons, which are used on phones because they're really interested in trying to keep real estate on the display to a minimum. Okay, so carrying on from there, Chris.
Actually, just before we go on, just before we go on from that, there is one other one that is fairly common, and that's where you get nine dots in a square. Google uses that on a lot of their products, where you'll have a square with nine dots laid out 3x3, and it is commonly called a bento box menu, or a candy box menu. So, but it's actually
what is a bento box?
A bento box is one of those food things that you get where it has, all little dividers for all the different, your dessert is in this, your salad is in this divider, and so forth. So it's just a box that is divided up.
Okay.
Okay. So we're going with...
Karen was just asking, is there a standard used? Is this type of item always located in a hamburger, a kebab, or a meatball? Generally, these icons are all menu type things, right, Chris?
Yeah. Any one company will usually standardize on using one of those three. And so you'll very commonly see them as either a hamburger menu for one company's product, or the company will use a kebab menu, or they will use a meatball menu. So it doesn't mean it's a type of menu. It is just the menu from a particular company. Okay, so I think we can go on to the next item here in clearing the browser cache. And this came in from B. And she was on a website, and she received a message saying that before reviewing all the improvements we've made, please be sure to clear your browser's cache and or launch an incognito window on your computer. And she was asking, why is it necessary? And then how do you do that? How do you clear the browser's cache without losing things you actually do want to keep? And she wondered if the cache should be cleared up regularly. And what she did do was used incognito mode, and the new edits on that particular website did show up properly. Next. Okay, so just going back to a little bit about why a web server would actually come up with a message like that. So all web browsers do cache content. And the reason behind it really dates back to mostly when we were on slow internet connections or were paying inordinate amounts for bandwidth. And the idea behind it was that if the content on a web page hadn't changed since the last time you were there, there's really no need to download the content again if they cache the content locally, and you could just read the content out of your web cache rather than downloading it again. Now, to me, a lot of this has really sort of gone away in terms of its real necessity because we tend to be on high-speed connections and have unlimited bandwidth and things like that. But that was the idea behind the web cache. Next. So the message said, before reviewing all the improvements we've made. So they were saying basically they had indicated that changes were made to the web page. Next. Now, your web browser should recognize that there are changes and download fresh copies of the new pages. Next. But that sometimes doesn't happen correctly. So sometimes they go haywire. The browser thinks that it has the up-to-date content and displays that rather than displaying the new content from the web page. So that's why they will tell you that you need to dump your cache or go into incognito mode. Next. So what are the ways to ensure that you get new content that gets downloaded to your computer? One of the ways is, as they said, clear the browser cache. And then if it clears the browser cache, you have no way for the browser to display old content. It has to download all of the new content from the website. So you'll be guaranteed of getting up-to-date content from that particular web server and all web servers for that matter. Next. The other way, and they mentioned this, is going into incognito mode. And this is also called private or in private windows. And what happens when you use incognito mode is that it does not use the local cache for either reading or writing content. And so it, again, forces the browser to download up-to-date content. Now, in theory, if you did an incognito mode window, you would get the new content. If you went back to a regular window, the potential is still there because it's going to be using the browser cache that you could actually still be reading old content. But at least you would have seen it once in the incognito mode, and then you could clear the browser cache afterwards if you need to. So clearing the browser cache can sometimes clean up some weird problems when you're browsing. So generally speaking, I would say that that is your better approach. Next. Okay, so if you want to clear the cache, so the menu option will probably be something like delete browser data. And I emphasize data because usually that's all they say, is it will, if you clear the cache, it will delete the data from your browser. So it may be more data than you actually intend to actually delete. You probably don't want to delete all browser data. What you want to delete is just cached web pages and graphics. So you probably don't want to clear other browser data like cookies, browser history, passwords, and so forth. Next. So when you clear the cache, it is going to clear the cache content for all the websites you have visited. There are ways you can actually try to delete cache content from a single website, but it's a pain in the butt. The biggest takeaway from this is if you delete the cache content and it goes away for all your websites, you don't really lose anything. The next time you visit the website, all the content will get re-downloaded and it'll get written into the cache as new content. So, you know, it will clear cache content for all websites. So you may have slightly slower response rate on some websites in the future that may have really heavy content. Next. I actually wondered whether caching is beneficial or not nowadays, because we're on high-speed connections, and I wondered, is it actually faster to download content again rather than look through a cache on a local hard drive that might be a slow hard drive and read the content from there? And so I asked Perplexity AI, and basically, the end of it came up with, while caching is generally beneficial for performance, the actual speed difference between the cache retrieval and downloading on high-speed connections may vary. And they actually did say that for small files, typically it will be faster to download again. Large files are typically faster gotten from the cache. So it's really a mixed bag, and I think deleting all your cache content is not going to be a real problem for most people. Next. Okay, so this is just a thing on how you go about clearing the cache. I won't belabor the issue on this. You can download the PDF of the deck later on if you don't know how to do this. But for Chrome, Edge, Brave, Opera, and Firefox, these are the menus you actually go through and to actually do the clearing of the content. And you'll see in the graphic on the right-hand side, you don't want to delete all things. You don't want to delete browsing history, download history, cookies, and other site data, things like that. All you want to delete is cached images and files. Those are the pieces of data that are not needed on your local computer, that they will get downloaded fresh next time you go to a particular website, and you won't lose anything if you just delete cached images and files. Next. So the other way of doing it is incognito mode. And I'm not seeing incognito mode. There we go. So if you don't want anything to be deleted, say you're on a really slow connection or something like that, or you're on a metered connection and you've used up all your data for the month, and so you really don't want to be deleting things and having to re-download them as you visit websites or whatever. So you can use incognito mode instead. So I have a link here to two articles that we've talked about before in the newsletter as well as at Q&A about what incognito mode really does, and you can review those at your leisure. I will post those into the chat after I'm done here. Next. So ways of getting to incognito mode, if you have the browser running, if you right-click its icon in the taskbar, or if it's pinned to the taskbar, when you get the pop-up window, you'll have something like new incognito window or new private window or new in private window. Next. And then from within the browser, you go to the menu, whether it's a kebab menu, a hamburger menu, or a meatball menu. And then you will have an option somewhere down in there for new incognito window or new private window or new in private window. And you notice it'll also have the keystrokes that you can just press to get that. And so Chrome, Edge, Brave, and Opera all use Control-Shift-N from within the browser to open up a new incognito window. Firefox goes its own way. Control-Shift-P will open up a private window in Firefox. And that's all I have for that. And I see a whole bunch of
Tom
stuff going
that.
In.
Tom noted that if you hit the F5 key, then that will reload the HTML page. Control and F5 reloads both the page and all the links. So links to pictures and JavaScript items that are on the page all get reloaded.
Okay, so that's loaded from the website as opposed to rereading the cache?
Yes, they get re-downloaded.
Oh, interesting. No, I did not know that. I did not know that. That's good.
Also, later down in the
F5 for the page and Control F5 for the page and the link.
Yeah.
Set to clear the cache every time she closes the browser, and she hasn't noticed any slowdown when she loads new pages after the cache has been cleared.
One of the things I find really annoying about web browser caches is most of them don't allow you to actually limit the size of the cache. And there are one or two that do allow you to limit that, but most of them don't. And they base the size of the cache on the amount of memory you have as well as disk space available. And they will automatically clear older content according to their parameters. Now, you can add parameters loading up browsers like Chrome with a parameter that will limit the size of the cache. But by default, within the user interface, there's usually no option to limit the size of the cache. So that idea of saying empty the cache every time you exit, probably not a bad idea.
Also, even if you have a 1.5 gigabit connection, that's only about 125 megabytes per second, and that's about anywhere from 10 to 100 times slower than SSD access on your own system, depending on how fast an SSD you have. So it's but everything's so fast these days, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that one, Tom.
So Karen has a question here. Basically, if we've ever done any comparison of browsers and search engines, looking at the pros and cons. And I don't have time right now to look for that. But
I don't think we have. We've had just ad hoc comments on that of people preferring one browser over another, but I don't think we've ever done a real straight up comparison between different browsers. They all have pluses and minuses, quite frankly. Some talk about being more secure than others. I think all of them have security problems, and all of them try to address the security problems. So many of them are based on the Chromium engine now, so that when it gets fixed for Chromium, I'm sure it gets fixed quite quickly for all of the major browsers, Firefox being the one that is the outlier on that, that they built their own engine and go their own way. But I have all the major browsers on my computer, and I will use different ones for different purposes.
And the other way to look at that is it's a golden opportunity for somebody out there to give a share on browsers and or search engines.
There you go.
So if that's of interest to you, let us know and we'll slot you into the program. Okay, next up I have a thing on a really basic thing on File Explorer. We keep asking what people would like to know about in terms of computer basics and topics for Q&A, and nobody ever says, so I'm going to give you this one. So the things that I do to customize File Explorer. I think everybody knows that you can use different layouts for File Explorer. You can have large icons or small icons, and you can have things like details. And this is what the thing looks like. If you look at a folder, this is the root of my data drive. So it's showing you a whole bunch of different folders as the large icons. And if I switch that view and look at the details and scroll down a bit, you can see that the top bit of the screen has got the various folders, and the bottom bit of the screen has got a bunch of individual files. So depending how you like to look at things, and there are various ways of viewing the content of your hard drive. And even within that, once you've got this details view, you notice that there's a bunch of tabs. So you're looking at the file name, you're looking at the date, basically it was last modified, the type of the file, whether it's a text file or an HTML file or a folder, and also the size of the file in kilobytes generally. And one of the things you can do with that is if you right click on that menu bar, then you will get this guy pops up, this context menu, and you can see that there are all kinds of parameters that you could display, dimensions of pictures and the date a file was created and all kinds of things like that. However, you can also disable things. So in this case, by default, it's showing the file type. Now I have my File Explorer to always show the extension. So I know if the file is a JPEG or a PDF or a text file. So I don't really need File Explorer to tell me what type it is. So I'm quite happy to disable that by unchecking that box and restricting my view to the things I really am interested in, which is the file name, the date, and the size. And then within that, you can actually sort these columns by these different parameters. So for example, on the left here is the folders and files in my on my data drive, sorted by date. But if I left click in that, in this area right here where it says date, then it will instantly resort everything. And instead of, I think this one is sorted by name. So it's doing the A's and then the B's and then everything else. Now I've told it to sort it by date. It's sorting it so the newest folder and file comes to the top of the list, and the older ones are down the bottom. And you can do that with file names. You can reverse the order of file names, and you can sort by size, so the biggest files come to the top, so you know which ones are taking the most space, etc., etc. And the other thing you can do within that menu is that you can rearrange the columns. If you just click on the size here and drag it over and drop it in between the name and the date, then that will basically rearrange the columns. So instead of being name, date, size, it's now name, size, date. So it's a pretty flexible system that you have. One of the things I like to do is, as well as having file name extensions checked, so it always shows me the file name, I also like to use checkboxes. So I've got this item checkboxes enabled. And when you hover over one of these files here, it pops up a checkbox, which you then click and click the next one and click the one down here. And you can see now very easily which files you have selected to do something with, to delete them or to move them or whatever. And so checkboxes are a very handy item. And the other thing you notice at the top here is a single checkbox. If you click on that guy, that's essentially select all. And if you click on it again, then it's unselect all. So that's a really nice way if you've got a folder and you want to delete a whole bunch of files in that folder, you can select them all at once and delete them all at once. Really quite useful. And some of the things you can do in the view is in the details you can have this details pane here. And so if you click on details pane, when you select the file, then you get this literally details pane on the right hand side, and it gives you more information about this particular file. It's an MSI file, so you know it's a Windows installer package. It was modified here. It's that big. It was created then. You get a certain amount of information about the actual file. And the other one that can be useful is the preview pane. So now I'm clicking on this JPEG file down here, and I'm getting a preview, a thumbnail view, if you like, of the actual image. And we're going a little side story here. The image is from a trip I took to Australia, and it's to do with the cassowary. The cassowary it's got a bad rep. According to Guinness Book of Records, it's the most dangerous bird in the world. That's actually not true in terms of birds killing people. Ostriches kill many more people than cassowaries do. But to some extent, that's just a numbers game. There's more ostriches around than there are cassowaries. But the cassowary is a big bird. It's an ostrich-like bird. It can be up to 2 meters tall, 70 kilograms in mass, and it has these huge feet and these huge claws, and that's what it uses to defend itself. So if you get in the way of one of those guys, you can be badly injured. And the other thing we're interested in are these things which in Britain we would call sleeping policemen, and over here I think we call them speed bumps or speed humps. And you see these guys in Ottawa, and you have to be careful you don't take the suspension out of your car when you're driving down the road at the posted speed limit, which really annoys me. Anyway, the reason I go for those two things is because, going back to my image, the Australian sense of humor never fails to amaze me. And here you can see that there was a warning sign here to say that, you know, be careful because there are wild cassowaries in the area. And if you hit one with your car, then you might be A, damage the cassowary, but B, probably damage your car. And there are also speed bumps in the area. But some bright spark Australian has taken his felt tip pen, and he says this is the before and this is the after. I like that. Okay, going back to my Windows File Explorer, there are tons of different options. You notice in the main window here, there's a bunch of different tabs. There's a home tab, a share tab, a view tab, and drive tools. And then within each tab, you have the ribbon. So you've got all these different options that you can play around with in the ribbon. And then even if you go to the options tab here, you'll get this pop-up window, which again gives you three more tabs, general view and search. And within each of these, there are multiple selections, scroll down for more. And it's a very flexible file management system. And I don't use very many features of it, but the ones I do use, I really like. All right, so moving along, that's my take on File Explorer from a Windows 10 perspective. Remember, I don't have any computers that run Windows 11, but one of us does. And he loves to bitch about it, don't you, Chris?
Yeah, I'm not one to shy away from taking Microsoft to task when they do something stupid. Windows 11, they've played around a fair amount with the File Explorer in Windows 11. Now, this wasn't in the original Windows 11. The Windows 11 original release, the File Explorer was pretty much the same as in Windows 10. However, one of the main things they've done recently is they actually removed the ribbon completely, and you can see the picture down at the bottom. It does not have the ribbon interface. So it does have a toolbar of sorts, and you can have drop-down menus and things like that from that. So most of the functionality is actually still there, but not quite all functionality. So some of them are under multi-level menus. So next. So you can see here I clicked on the view, and then you get that the options there for the extra large icons, details, all the rest of them, in a drop-down list rather than a section within the ribbon. Now, quite frankly, I never was really a big fan of the ribbon because I thought it took up a huge amount of real estate on the screen. You could have it auto-hide, but anytime you wanted to actually access anything, you know, you had this big ribbon interface that was in your face. So I kind of like, personally, I like this idea of a more abbreviated things and, you know, some of the stuff being buried down two clicks away. Well, I mean, it could be a little inconvenient, but you don't often go to change some of those options. So it's more a getting to know what is where rather than, you know, having to click a lot of extra times just to get to an option. Next. So some options that can only be had on the ribbon are totally missing now in File Explorer in Windows 11. And the one example that I really pull out of this is that if you use file history, you absolutely need to be able to have access to file history as a menu option if you need to recover deleted files. If you want to just get an older version of an existing file, you can just right-click on the file and choose properties, and then there will be a file history tab, and you can go through the history and pull out an old one from your backups. But if you have a deleted file, you have nothing to right-click on. So that's where the ribbon option, as you see in the picture there, would actually bring up a user interface where you could actually go through and get older versions of files, including files that have been deleted from the file system in your current situation. Next. So there is a way in Windows 11 that you can still get the ribbon interface, which is a very curious way of going about doing it. If you go to Control Panel and then you hit that up arrow you see in the menu bar twice, it'll actually display File Explorer with the ribbon interface. Next. So here we see Windows 11's normal File Explorer, if you just get it from the toolbar or whatever, and it does not have the ribbon. Next. But if you go to Control Panel, hit that up arrow twice, then you end up getting copy of File Explorer with the ribbon. So it works for anybody who needs access to the history button that is now only in the ribbon interface in order to be able to get at deleted files from file history. Next. And this will work until Microsoft realizes the mistake they made in actually making it available to people and take it away. So I think at some point they will probably realize that, this is no good, and they'll probably take away that up arrow hit in Control Panel so that you can actually get into a regular File Explorer view of things. At some point, they're probably going to end up removing it, at which point there is one other way that you can actually get to file history, and that's through Control Panel, not through the Settings app, in order to be able to recover deleted files. And that's the end of my rant for File Explorer.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. All right, so our last item on the scheduled event here is from Bob Harris. He's going to talk to us about video chats.
And Bob, you're going to unmute yourself.
Thank you. And here and we should see a file coming up. 1, 2. I don't see it yet.
It just says it's started.
There it goes.
There we go. Got it.
We're live here now. Okay. Thank you, folks. So now we'll jump into the magical world of video chats. How exciting can this be? Okay. So our club meetings run very smoothly on Zoom. But what do you folks do for individual calls? I'm guessing many of us don't really use Zoom otherwise. The free Zoom accounts always have that dreaded cutoff when the time runs out, and buying a paid account it can be expensive. Now, moving forward. Raise your hand if anybody here has ever tried to set up a video chat with a friend by telephone. I help others at times, but for something like this, I'm the one that usually needs help. Video conferencing can be very tough, and I'm certainly no expert. Now, I'm sure many of you are thinking about these things already, activation updates, passwords, and usernames, and it goes on forever. And it can be very daunting for me anyway. So I'll ask you all a question. Would you and folks you know use video chat more if it was easy to use? Quick and easy to use. Well, now video chat is easy for anyone to use and everyone to use. Imagine a world with no time limits, no installation, no downloads, no logins, just instant video communication. The video chat superhero you've been waiting for has arrived. Say hello to Yep.com, the instant, hassle-free video chat platform designed to make your life easier. HeyYep is the ultimate video chat platform. It syncs up with any device. It's as easy as texting or sending an email. And you can use this on any device. Here it is, as views a login screen at HeyYep.com on a Windows desktop PC. You can see there's not many buttons here. I can handle this one. And here it is being used on a desktop PC. I'm the handsome guy right there, okay? Anyway, this is a great program, or a web-based platform, they call it. And you can use it on cell phones. It worked the first time I tried it. This is my wife, Debbie. In this case, she's logged in twice, once on her tablet, and then once again on her cell phone. And it's instant. There's nothing to it. It's just so simple, you won't believe it. So let's review some of the key details here. As I mentioned, there's no login or email required. It's completely free to use. It has no time limits. Works on Androids, PCs, iPhones, Macs, and it works cross-platforms. You can mix these things up. Everybody jumps in. Everybody syncs. No downloads required. You can have up to 12 people on your video chat call. For everybody, the experience is it'll open instantly with a link. Now, Yep doesn't require folks to make accounts or personal information for its services. So this reduces the amount of personally identifiable information. And Yep explicitly states it does not track or store user data. Everything is on the fly. There's no storing of call logs. They don't store video recordings. It doesn't store any form of any activity. Once the call is done, it's done. So that's about everything for Yep. It truly is. I have one more thing to go. It truly is an amazing thing. It's made by a couple of fellows from California, Wayne Lev and Brian Lord. Their goal was to create a web-based platform for free, spontaneous communication anywhere in the world. I think they've done it. And I don't think it costs them much to run this. There are other businesses, and this just runs along. I do believe they have a commercial one with your web branded, you're at Microsoft, whatever, you can use the Yep, but it'll have the Microsoft name on it. They do and have that. Now, I do have one job for you folks here now. I'm sure everybody here will have no problem at all using this HeyYep.com. But if you know somebody that has problems with technology, but they can do email and texting, I encourage you to go and help them a little bit and set them up with a a heyyep.com video chat. They can do it. They can start their own chats later. They'll find it easy to do. All they need is a device with a camera and a microphone. That's any tablet, any cell phone, used on Wi-Fi. Some folks might be thrilled to connect with loved ones. They couldn't otherwise do this. So this is your chance to help somebody else. Try it yourself first. I guarantee you will find it amazingly simple. And enjoy it. Thank you all.
That sounds great,
Bob. Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's the last item we had on the agenda. So if there are any other questions people have, now is the time. I noticed one in the chat. Karen says, sometimes certain file types, currently Word documents, won't preview in File Explorer. Where do I go to change this? I don't know if you can. Anybody know the answer to that one?
It's built in. I forget what they call them. Internet filter or something like that. So it's basically built into File Explorer, and they do update it periodically for different file types, but by and large, they don't do an awful lot of updates. I'm really surprised that they haven't pushed out an update that would handle any Word format, seeing as it is from Microsoft that this is coming. One workaround for that you might be able to use is the PowerToys. The PowerToys have the ability to preview more file types than is built into Windows itself. So you could try that. Other than that, I don't think there's anything you can do to actually change the behavior of File Explorer to recognize more file types.
A couple of questions for Bob. If Debbie was using it on a tablet, Bob, it must be available on Android. Is that correct?
Actually, it was an iPad tablet.
Does it work on Android?
Android's fine, yes. Android is fine.
I think it should work in any web browser, right? I mean, as long as you've got a working web browser that can handle graphical file formats, I think you should have no problem at all.
And it's amazingly quick. Like, it truly is instant. I've done it a number of times, and it's foolproof. So I think some folks that, anyway, share it a little bit more, you'll like it.
Darren wants to know how you find other Yep users.
Oh, you can't. There's no they can't track you either.
So how do you actually contact the people you
want
to
talk to? When you want to go, you go to your screen, you go to help.com, and you want to you click on set up a call. Here's my link here. Set up a call. It'll put a link into your computer. You copy and paste that into a text or an email.
Okay, to your friend or relative, I guess.
Yes, and if you can send an email, you can set up a call.
Okay, and the question was, does it use data? I guess it does if you're using data, but it won't if you're using Wi-Fi.
That's correct.
And Tom wants to know if you can screen share with it.
No, you cannot. I did ask that question. You cannot. Well, you can't share your desktop, but everybody can see everybody's face. You can hold your picture up, I guess. You can hold, but there's no other way to. You can hold your thing up you want to do, but you can't do a screen share like I did tonight.
I guess it's basically just doing your web camera and your microphone is what's being transmitted. Period.
Yeah, and I tried it on a test Zoom call, and you can't do it with Zoom at the same time. The camera's already in use.
Yeah, microphones, I think, can be split in their use, but webcams, they get locked for exclusive use by the first app that grabs it, and then nothing else is allowed to use the webcam.
And I haven't tried with the camera off, really. You might be able to. I don't know that.
Okay, should be able to. That was one of the other questions. Jeff's asking whether you can do conference calls. Well, clearly you can because, A, you had three screens on one of your slides, and you also said it can take up to 12 users, so that must be a conference call. And he's asking if you can run it with no video if you have low bandwidth. And I guess the answer is you don't know, right?
I do not know. But
oh, I'm sure it would. You would just get a blank square for that particular person who has their webcam turned off. But it's picking up whatever it can from the webcam and the microphone. If it gets nothing, it'll just do the microphone. If you turn off your microphone as well, there's not much point in having a call.
Okay, so there's a bunch of questions about cameras and no cameras. It's one of those things, if you try it, somebody, give us a follow-up demonstration next week and everybody will know all about it.
You go to heyup.com,
Karen says she just downloaded it for Android and SOFA says it's a low reputation app. It doesn't say why.
No, it's not an app. It's web-based anyway, but
yeah. It's probably low reputation website is really what they're saying. And the reason why it'd be low rep is just that there's not an awful lot of users out there that have validated that this is not a malicious website. Is probably all it amounts to. Low rep apps and things, warnings like that don't give me an awful lot of pause for concern. It's just not widely used is really what it amounts to.
Apparently it has one, I remember researching this, it had 128 encryption, and that's something comparable to military grade, but I don't think it's for use by lawyers and that, but if you want to call a friend and on the phone call and you want to shift over to a heyup.com call, you can do it instantly. Really, you can send an email, you can do it. Anyway, give it a shot.
Thanks very much, Bob. You inspired a bunch of people. They say they're going to try it and they really like your presentation.
Thank you all.
Okay, so
good evening.
There are a couple of questions, Bob. They want to know how you find all these different programs. Maybe you have to tell us that one of these days. Okay, so just wrapping up. Next week is our next Q&A session, Wednesday the 24th. You've got a whole bunch of ideas for shares for people. If you have more questions, or you can answer some of the questions that are in the chat window that we haven't got to, let us know. And as usual, we'll add you to the list. So I hope everybody enjoyed all the different stuff we had tonight, many and varied, I guess. So that's it for me, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.